Let's start with a little reflection on St. Bernard, today's saint, the great, the remarkable 12th century abbot, doctor of the church. Somewhere along the way, I was taught that if you say St. Bernard, you mean the saint, and if you say St. Bernard, you mean the dog, the breed of dog with a big barrel of whiskey or brandy under his neck. Probably the French don't make that distinction, I don't know. He's French, St. Bernard. A man of extraordinary gifts, remarkable ability to attract people. As I was reading a little bit about him, a little detail just thrown out among the many achievements, he founded 68 monasteries. I thought of that, 68 monasteries? Who's even visited 68 monasteries? Who's even heard of 68 monasteries? Founding one monastery is a remarkable achievement. He founded 68 monasteries. So he had this ability to attract people to the Christian way of life, to the monastic way of life. He almost single-handedly got the Second Crusade in motion. It turned out to be a disaster, but that he could even do it is just extraordinary. And he had influence over popes and over saints and over kings, Saint Bernard. So he's just a remarkable person. And really the center of the final flowering of the monastic movement up into the 12th century. After him, the next great development in church history was the mendicant orders. So St. Francis of Assisi is the primary example. So St. Francis of Assisi was born in around 1181 or 1182. St. Bernard died in 1163 or 1153, what was it? 1153. So just 30 years later, along comes St. Francis. And St. Francis saw in the monasteries luxury and corruption and failure to live according to the gospel way of life. And he said, no, we can't live the gospel way of life with possessions and with buildings and properties. We have to be free of all that. So it was another kind of revolution that St. Francis and St. Dominic started. But St. Bernard, they never met, of course. But if he had met St. Bernard, he might have had a different, St. Francis might have had a different view of monastic life, because he would have recognized the holiness of St. Bernard. Everybody knew it. Everybody saw what kind of extraordinary man he was. I don't know if there's anybody like that nowadays. The closest I can think of is St. John Paul II. Big personality, magnetic personality, capability of traveling all over, changing world history. Not many people are like that. But anyway, St. Bernard is one of them. Let's take a look at the readings. When I ponder the readings today, I was reminded of some very fundamental themes that keep coming up when you look at the scriptures. Certain things just keep coming up. One of them is what you could call the theme of restoration. The idea that we're in a mess, or we're in trouble, or we're in sin, or we're under oppression, or we're dead, and God, because of his goodness and his love, he decides to save us from the mess. That's certainly what happens in today's first reading. So Prophet Ezekiel says, the Lord says to Ezekiel, I'm going to prove the holiness of my name. I'm going to pick up my people and gather them again. I will be their God. They shall be my people. I will be their God. I'm going to restore my people. So this theme comes up again and again. You can think of, for example, the Exodus, rescuing the Israelites from slavery in Egypt. Restoration, the freedom, restoration to the promised land. Or Lazarus in the tomb. Come up out of the tomb. I restore you from a dead condition. This comes up again and again. Of course, the center of it all is Jesus rising from the tomb himself and restoring sinful and condemned humanity to new life. That's one thing. Another thing that comes up a lot, and this comes up a lot in August, is the idea of royal royal dignity and glory. So we're in the month of glory, and when we describe glory, we tend to use images of royalty, sitting on thrones, golden crowns, power, splendor. Well, we're going to celebrate the queenship of Mary on Saturday. That's a good example of it. How do you describe the glory of heaven? What, we use royal imagery. Okay, that's just one thing. Then another thing that comes up very often is the theme of the wedding. The idea that a wedding feast represents the kind of the high point of celebration and of union and of joy. This is deep in the human psyche. In every culture, a wedding is somehow an achievement to celebrate. Now, everyone who's married knows that it's not all bliss and banquets, but it still remains in our mind. This represents the goal, unity, love, permanence, blissful harmony. You know, the beautiful princess and the handsome prince in a glorious setting. Okay, so that's part of what's in this reading too. Now, today's gospel is a parable about a king inviting people to a wedding banquet for his son, or a wedding feast of his son. So it draws on this imagery of unity, of celebration, of joy, of love, and that's always appealing. Even in modern times, when people don't get married anymore, you know, the percentage of people getting married is lower than it has ever been in human history, and for some reason, or many reasons, money, fear of commitment, lack of understanding of love, and all the distractions in modern life, marriage is declining. But even when it's declining, people recognize that it represents a kind of ideal. In fact, it's a very good symbol of heaven. Heaven is a wedding feast, and to go to heaven is to be become part of the celebration of love. And Jesus himself uses this kind of imagery. But here in the parable, the beautiful feast of the king's son is somehow not appreciated. And the parable brings up a lot of strange details which don't really fit. I mean, we can't take them literally, of course, because otherwise the king turns into a ferocious figure, and he burns the city down and all these things, has this guy thrown out into the darkness. And people who have that kind of image of God have a very distorted image of God. Maybe they get it from stories like this, but there are people who think that if they do everything right, then they'll remain in the favor of the king, and as soon as they make one mistake, they're out. That's how people think, and it's not right. Maybe that kind of mentality comes from seeing how tyrants work. I remember reading not long ago about the leader of North Korea, whatever they call him, not dictator, some kind of supreme leader of North Korea. People who are in his good graces do everything to agree with him. And as soon as you're out of his favor, you could be killed. I mean, it's a black and white. You're either 100% for the supreme leader, or you're at risk of death. And some people treat God like that. He's not like that. But this parable might give that wrong impression, because when the people refuse the invitation and kill the servants, the king is enraged, sends his troops, destroys the murderers, and burns their city. In the meantime, all the food is just waiting. So it doesn't make sense. But the idea, I think, that we're supposed to get from this is we have this grand invitation from the Lord, an extraordinary opportunity to be brought into joy, celebration, love, unity. And if we don't take it, if we refuse it, it has terrible consequences. God doesn't have to burn down our cities. Our decision to refuse his invitation is disastrous to us. I think that's what we're supposed to learn from this part of the parable. But the invitation remains for everybody. If the first ones invited don't come, well then I'll invite other people. I want to have a big celebration with lots of people. And that's what happens. Everybody gets invited, and those who show up, they make it. But then there's this strange detail about the one with the wrong kind of clothing. He's not wearing the wedding garment. You know, the tradition is that a garment was provided. If that's the case, it's clear why this man is judged so harshly, because he didn't use what was provided for his participation. It's not that clear from what we read, but what's very clear is that every person who accepts the invitation also has a responsibility. So it's the invitation is purely from the benevolence of the king, or in our case, the goodness of God, the love of God, regardless of our condition, not because of our worthiness. The invitation comes because God is overflowing with love, and he wants everyone to have a share in it. He wants everyone to be part of the wedding. That's God's initiative, and it remains that way no matter what we say or who we are or what we've done. But if we want to participate, if we say yes to the invitation, we do have to do our part. We have to cooperate. We can't force our impurity on the holiness of God, or we can't force our selfishness into the kingdom as if God has to submit to us. That can't work. So if we don't accept the wedding garment, if we don't say yes to the journey that God invites us on, well then we're thrown out. Now it's not that God is capricious and when he gets mad he throws people out. We exclude ourselves by wrong choices. So when we hear many are invited but few are chosen, it is mysterious how people experience the call of God. It's very mysterious. We don't know how and when and why people experience it. We don't even understand it ourselves. Why have you experienced the call from God? Why are you here on a Thursday morning? I mean, well, God moved your heart. God extended an invitation to you, and you said yes to it. Even though you're not worthy, and even though you don't respond perfectly, you're here. But what about this, few are chosen? Well, we don't know why some people are like St. Bernard, and some people aren't, but we do know that the response of a new heart, that the one who cooperates with the grace of baptism is made new. We are chosen. We've already been chosen. And we remain chosen as long as we're willing to be included. And the only thing that excludes us is ourselves, our own sins. So it's a warning against the disastrous decision to sin, to turn in on ourselves, to turn away from God, to rely on ourselves. But in a positive sense, it's more, well, let's see what a great invitation is extended to us. And not complain about the price or the sacrifice of having to leave other things behind in order to enter the wedding banquet. Nothing is as important as our union with God. Nothing. So don't let anything get in the way of saying yes to the invitation to the wedding feast.